Okay, we have a few people coming in yet, but I think I'll get started. I'll begin by reminding you to turn off your cell phones, if you would, please. Thank you very much. And then I'll officially start by welcoming you to Tuesday Evenings at the Modern. I'm Terry Thornton, and it's my great privilege to work with this very special program. I think most of you, but I do see a few new faces, I just want to alert you that this is an ongoing series. And so I invite you back. It happens every Tuesday this year, or this spring, through the run. It runs through the end of March. I invite you to get online and check out the lineup on the Modern's website. Very simple, www.themodern.org. Next week, so you can go ahead and mark your calendars, is Fahamu Peku. And he's an exciting young artist who's working in Atlanta on a branding campaign for his own career as a painter. His project, Fahamu Peku is the Shit, began in 2002 with paintings of the artist on the cover of art and culture magazines. He did T-shirts, posters, a mockumentary, and guerrilla street art. And it's fashioned after similar celebrity campaigns that Peku created for various rap and hip-hop artists through his design business, which is under the name Diamond Lounge. And all of this is going to be the subject of his presentation, Behind the Canvas, you know, like behind the music. But behind the canvas. So come early, and I hope you'll come early and spend time in the galleries, because the galleries are open on these Tuesdays during the run of the lecture series for your convenience. And I hope you'll get in and see the permanent collection. It's a beautiful installation, and you know how seldom we get to have all of that up, so I encourage you to take advantage. Tonight we are fortunate to have one of the art world's new curatorial talents, Nicola Vassal. She's here to present her position that, and I'm quoting, a new and grittier form of abstraction permits us to theorize that a younger generation of painters, consciously or not, is producing ruggedly electric paintings that tell somber and vicious tales, making a statement on the socio-political inevitability of a world gone mad. Something that I witnessed in an exhibition titled Subtraction that Nicola curated last spring at Deitch Projects in New York. It happened to include the work of the Modern's next focus show artist, Rosin Crow, along with other young, exciting painters, and its quality and intrigue is, in fact, the impetus for my invitation to Nicola to participate in the Tuesday evening lecture series this spring. Her lecture tonight is titled Dark Art, A New Conversation with Abstraction, and I've been looking forward to it for some time. Nicola Vassal was born in Kingston, Jamaica, and moved to New York in 1996 as a fashion model working for top designers and magazines. While modeling was a lucrative field, much more so than perhaps art, Nicola explains in a recent New York Times article by Felicia Lee that she wanted something more for her life, which I presume is what led her to pursue an art history and business degree at NYU while working as a culture reporter for Trace magazine and a culture and art writer for Vibe magazine. Since that pivotal decision, Nicola has gone on to co-edit and coordinate the book project Jean-Michel Basquiat, 1981, The Studio of the Street, and to coordinate the exhibition and book Francesco Clemente Works, 1971 through 1979. In the spring of 2007, she curated Powers of Ten, Successive Orders of Formal and Psychological Magnitude. And as I mentioned, a year ago, she curated the exhibition Subtraction, which was reviewed by the highly respected and sometimes feared Roberta Smith, critic for the New York Times. Nicola currently holds the coveted position of director at Deitch Projects in New York, where she has been since 2005, working with promising, accomplished young artists like Rosin Crow and Kehinde Wiley. It is Nicola's position at Deitch and her role in a drastically volatile if not volatile, at least changing art world that was the topic of a shaper of talent for a changing art world, which is the aforementioned article by Felicia Lee. And in that article, Lee closes with Nicola's take on the subject of change in the art world, and I quote, "There are so many possibilities. If you cut out the excess and extravagance, what you'll have is a return to personal creativity, a rich creativity that has nothing to do with how much money you have. It's what many of us came into this business for." So with those words of encouragement, please join me in welcoming Nicola Vassallo.
Hello, good evening, everyone. Seems I have to hire Terry to be my PR person now. Sounded so good. Thank you so much. First of all, I'd like to thank you, Terry, for inviting me, having me here in Texas at the Modern. It's a great honor, and I look forward to expounding and discussing this theory on new abstraction. So, hi, everyone. Welcome. Get comfortable. We're going to get right into it. Hey, John, take it away. What is abstract art? Abstract art is an extraordinary system of reductions and destructions that articulates the infinite possibility of expression. It provides a continuously fertile dimension to artistic discourse and donates a stream of radical innovations to cultural existence, as seen here by this wonderful Picasso. This was the beginning of the fracturing of the figure, which was a completely avant-garde and new concept. So it is not an indistinguishable hierarchy of symbols or obtuse set of eventualities, but an involved human communication that requires intellectual detective work and knowledgeable administration. That is to say, abstract art does not destroy representation. In fact, it expands the possibilities. Matisse, in his Notes of a Painter, points out that all the great discoveries in art and life are simple, familiar truths seen new. Relative to abstraction, this might mean learning to read a new language or a different set of codes that one normally encounters, say, in neoclassical figurative painting, like this, by The Death of Marat by David. However, a drips, flatter, thickly or thinly applied strip, line, or layer of paint could mean fear, happiness, seduction, indifference, or absolution. The fact is, we just have to figure out how to read between the signs, and the less we immediately recognize, the closer we must look. It can be said that materiality holds a primary role in narrating the stories and emotional quotient of abstract art. It couldn't be truer than when we look at the new strain of abstraction that I loosely term substraction. The idea of substraction did not arrive in one piece, however. I had been grappling with the idea of how one might contextualize the angst of a post 9/11 generation. That is, those entering adulthood, accepting adulthood, or settling into adulthood at the turn of the 21st century. So you have your 20s, your 30s, your 40-somethings. The overarching difficulty faced by this group navigating a world descended into delusion, fanaticism, irrationality, absurdity, and imbalance. Not simply because of 9/11 itself, but the concurrent and extreme shifts in population density, therefore stress, information capability, war, social injustice, environmental deterioration, poverty and wealth disparity, celebrity worship, luxury obsession, result and final greed. In all seriousness, there had to be some way of encapsulating this in a configuration that inevitably holds a mirror to society. After much assessment and advice, the dominant and fitting path was via new abstraction. Though substraction can be broadly applied, I will primarily examine its position in painting. Okay, so now comes the meaty, fun part. We're going to start with a young artist, Dan Colin, who I know quite well. Dan Colin draws from subculture, urban American landscapes, and the dark side of life. He infuses the commonplace and overlooked with a cool detachment and a wicked sense of irony. Subterfuge is a chief aim, and in his work, he manages to achieve immediacy of expression but slipperiness of meaning. He literally reinvigorates the drip painting with Pollockian measure in the work that you saw previously, and then this detail, which he calls his birdship paintings, where spatters and drips across the canvas meant to evoke bird droppings dissolve the distinction between figure and ground. An even dispersal of pictorial incident over most of the canvas offers the feel of anti-composition and quasi-all-over unity. Other examples of his witty abilities are the irreverent bubblegum paintings, which we see here. This is a large-scale abstraction, essentially created by chewed bubblegum. Then we have the lipstick here. Colin describes them as having the residue of performance instead of committing to the deliberate force of action. Next up we have Rudolf Stingel, who to many is the reigning master of rigorously sublime conceptual painting. His approach is perturbing and profound, though the materials under his employ are mundane and stripped of any personality in any other context. So, in the words of Roberta Smith, and I quote, "For nearly 20 years, he has made work that seduces the eye while also upending most notions of what exactly constitute a painting, how it should be made, and by whom. Beauty, humor, euphoria, a democratic slant, and a resolute sense of economy form the core of Mr. Stingel's art. He combines a love of painting with a postmodern suspicion of it, and often achieves a near perfect balance between the visual and the conceptual. Optical intensity without sentimentality might be Mr. Stingel's motto. He seems to define paintings foremost as flat surfaces that radiate visual power in unfamiliar terms. Opulence is countered by austerity. Spectacle is undercut by banality. All processes are transparent and simple as possible. Skill is continually reinvented and always less central than thought. Abstraction less important than physicality." So the work you saw before is a famous pink styrofoam work where each scoop that you saw function as a large brushstroke. Then here you have the kind of grotesquely dissolved white styrofoam piece where Stingel walks into the styrofoam with boots dipped in lacquer thinner, which melts the styrofoam. I think also one of the interesting things to do is look back at the history of modernist painting and where the beginnings of someone like Stingel's thought might have been born. And so something that came to mind was Fontana, Lucio Fontana's Concerto Spaziale. I think this is really exquisite slash of the canvas, not unlike Stingel's treatment of canvas. This is an oil painting that Stingel did that in many ways also reminds me of Andy Warhol's oxidation paintings. You have the same reverence of decay and deterioration, but there's a simple elegance to it as well. So that's Stingel. And now we move on to Mark Bradford, another of my favorite young abstractionists. Bradford transforms excavated billboards, posters, and other material scavenged from the street into wall-sized collages and installations that respond to the impromptu networks, underground economies, migrant communities, or popular appropriation of abandoned public space that emerge within a city. Bradford's collages are often compared to modernist abstract painting, of course, which is why we're talking about him. Yet his is an abstraction that comes more from the urban sprawl of his native Los Angeles. So you can see it sort of looks like an aerial map of various cities, though it's sort of debris and found objects constructing the object. So according to Bradford, there is an abstraction that happens in the city, a dislocation of reality when you have the Mexican taqueria next to the black wig shop across the street from the Korean nail shop. So I think he investigates it quite wonderfully, and, you know, wonderful textures. And I chose these paintings because I think they offer a view of the sublime. This is very dark, brooding paintings, and I think Mark is investigating that with his discussion of community. Next is a wonderfully young artist, Jedediah Caesar. Jedediah is young and fairly, you know, new relative to the other painters. Caesar is an artist who offers a new kind of organicism in abstraction by the method of agglomeration. By that I mean accumulating junk and debris is the fundamental operation of his practice. Trash becomes treasure when Caesar puts refuse into a container and fills it with clear or color resin. The resulting resin blocks are cut into geometrical forms that reveal a kaleidoscopic arrangement of shapes and staggers beneath polished surfaces. As a result, tension is an inner event, and exquisite angst is successfully contained. Now, Caesar's, this is a detail, so you get a sense of what the interior of the resin block is. I think there's a beauty to the trash. He somehow manages to pull out the grotesque with the beautiful. Caesar's dichotomous result brings to mind Eva Hesse's work, Accession 2, that depicts an inwardly ferocious but externally sedate object. Perhaps a similar psychological and social innovation has been achieved. This is a view of his room at the Whitney Biennial last year, 2008. He was one of the standout artists of that exhibition, but I do think that his best days are still to come. So let's keep an eye on Jedediah. The next artist is Anselm Reile. Reile's paintings are instantly recognizable as responses to the formalist vocabulary of Clement Greenberg, the theories that defined art of the 50s and 60s. There's an obvious attention to the materiality, which is sort of the segment of discussion here. He has quite a bit in common with one of his contemporaries, Stephen Perino, who I wanted to include but could not because of timing and all that stuff. So I think his works are wonderfully harmonious, yet you can, you know, the struggle of material maintains a certain tragedy in it. So that segment sort of encapsulates material. So these are young artists or artists who are operating in the sphere of newness, or whose works are being embraced as heralding something interesting and new. Now, the second segment we're going to move on to is what I call the spirit. We need to explore the spirit of these wonderfully rugged abstractions. The spirit tells a different sort of tale, and by that I do not mean religious. Abstraction does its job most effectively when a range of intuitions, good or bad, supersede every other evocation. It is what Kirk Varnadale referred to as a picture having its own weather. It is the visceral reaction invoked by the silence or throb of a work, for that matter, the ball of fury hurling from a canvas. The essence incites numerous references and certainly brings about multiple meanings. So here I have the works of 30-something a Renaissance man, because he's a painter, he's a sculptor, he does fantastic drawings, and you'll find that most of these artists are operating on several different levels. They're not purists, they're not pure abstractionists, they're what I call part-time abstractionists. So Ruby's giant spray-painted canvases give ode to the most street of art, graffiti. I mention the means to his end because it is the traditionally vagrant method that allows his paintings to achieve an atmospheric transcendence. In SV20, which is this one, a three-part tragedy come redemption unravels. The first depiction feels dark, brooding, and largely threatening. The overwhelming sense is that the participant is either locked in or locked out. The second installment suggests that darkness clears to some degree, but a toxic tension still pervades. A breakthrough in the final picture affirms salvation. A fluorescent but slightly clouded utopia comes into view. This triumvirate could refer to any number of circumstances, but the spirit of the ideal and its inherent fragility comes to mind. Also, the works of Mark Rothko came to mind. Often his work is tied to a sort of religious spirit, spirituality, but I think there's a quietude and an introspection that relates from Sterling's paintings to this modern master's. Next, we're looking at the work of Chaney Thompson, another young artist. Chaney imbues his abstract paintings with a certain kind of weather. And these two grayscale oil paintings evoke a distinct sense of isolation. Like Cy Twombly's untitled 1970 painting of a chalkboard with white scribbles, the palette and brushwork in Thompson's works create a hazy illusion of texture, depth, and density nowhere centralized by perspective. Analysis of Thompson's formal process displaces any overly mystical reading. The imagery, in fact, derives from blurred photocopies, but the essence, I think, remains intact. Next, we have a young painter with whom my gallery works. Her name is Elizabeth Neal. She was part of this abstraction show, as was Sterling. She is the granddaughter of Alice Neal, the great figurative portraitist. I mean, I think it's in her DNA, must be in her DNA. But I believe that Elizabeth also pushes the spirit in abstraction forward with rugged and violent compositions that keep her well in line with the toughest New York school men. The first painting, the painting before, was called The Losers, and this painting is called The More, The Merrier. It somehow gives effect of what is dead and long forgotten. I don't feel comfort when, engaging with these paintings. There's a violence and there's a very somber tone. There is a very, 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 if you look closely, slight hint of figuration. The palette is contradictory. It's sort of drippy texture. It makes whatever is being depicted seem very sad. I thought firstly of Clifford Steele when I encountered Elizabeth's paintings. And Clifford, I mean, he also struggled with the notions of death and life and their interactions and how one could portray that relationship. Now, so that ends our segment on the spirit. The next segment is what I call the IQ of method. The abstractionist's method of arriving at a set of values or codes that underlie the meaning of his or her work is one of the few keys that can be used to decipher the original concept. Now, this is the work of Taube Auerbach, and she is also works with Deitch projects, and she is really one of the most fascinating and conceptually rigorous artists I work with, you know, of her age. So Taube basically uses signs and semiotics, and primarily language, to update minimalist and geometric abstraction traditions while maintaining rigorous concepts and didactic tenets. This is the Morse alphabet code with no spaces. This is a great piece that looks something like a bit of op art. This is actually the inside spaces of each numeral that in which space can be contained. So you see the 4 at the upper left. I guess that must be the 6 next to it, the 8, the 9, and the 0. That also, she updates this fantastic tradition of layering numbers and letters. And this is the whole alphabet from the center out digitally. She'd done a color version, but I thought this would be more appropriate. So here it is. She takes Jasper Johns's fantastic layering, tradition of layering, to a very contemporary level. I think the digital aspect gives it a new twist and a new wit. Now, the other fascinating thing about Taube is that a lot of her work is based on binary language, which is used in all digital technology and is comprised of sequences of tiny signals. So you have either on or off, yes or not yes. It is a black and white world where there's no maybe, no kind of, no gray. Any ambiguity must be simulated by arranging these unambiguous units. The strategy being that one can approach a more believable gray or half tone by using smaller and smaller units. So Taube did a series of about 10 50-50 works where they are in various positions of on or off. Now, this was a huge leap forward for Taube, in my opinion. This is a crumple painting, and her crumple paintings consist of seemingly uniform op art ink dot fields that, at a distance, resolve into images of crumpled paper. So this is a perfectly flat plane, but the illusion of depth is clearly there. Now, this work was up in the gallery, it, you know, the closer you got to it, the less it made sense, and the further away you got from it, it worked out. Her aim is to conflate order and chaos into one state or object. Now, this brought to mind Victor Vasarely, for me, the godfather of this optical illusion-based art, and I think they make a fine pair. This is the installation of... She did a companion crumple painting, and so this is the installation view from a distance at the gallery, and there's her 50-50 floor, which even though it's half black, half white, it sort of aggressively fights against that kind of equality. The next young artist I want to introduce to you is a young he's really a conceptualist, but he found the most interesting non-traditional methods of painting. This is a piece, a small sliver of a larger work called Greeting Card, where Aaron got a gang of motorcycle riders to come in and burn through paint on wood. So essentially he had spent a long time layering wood with, I think, a pink and a yellow paint, and finally covered it with black, and then brought the motorcycle gang in and heat, compression, rubber, you know, and movement created this pattern. I mean, one could think of Bryce Marden's work, Christopher Wool's work, but I think this gives an interesting update. Now, this is step moving forward when Aaron experimented with different materials. This is on aluminum, so he sort of burnt through the existing top layer of the aluminum, so this gives a wonderful silver on silver effect. And so it's a four-paneled piece, each panel being about 6 by 12 feet. Now, the apex of this effort, I think, ended here. Terry, you remember this from? This was in his abstraction. And the wildness, the ferocity, the angst, the anger, the violence, I think, is so wonderfully contained in this triple-paneled piece. So what you have is a combination of sort of maroon red and the black laid on top, which I just discussed, and then the kickstand of the motorbike created all that negative space that you see. So it was a purely, it was a happenstance. It was a chance. He could not create this painting again. We asked. He couldn't. The next piece, this is also from that series, the densely packed motorcycle gesture, I think, gives it a wonderfully lyrical vibe. And he began to experiment with colors, and I think, you know, he did great justice to the tradition of abstract painting. So here is the craft in motion. So he's sort of the conductor of the symphony. It's a very performative work on top of it. It's very sort of vibrous and terrifying. And I appreciate his radical method. I think it's also a very masculine approach to a very all-American, this thing of the bike and the, you know, the roughness and the, I just find it very male. There's a very male character inside of that whole situation. Okay, now the next painter we're going to look at is Julie Meritu. She's a fairly well-established artist, but I thought her works sort of fit wonderfully with this group. So Julie makes large-scale gestural paintings that are built up through layers of acrylic paint on canvas overlaid with making using pencil, pen, ink, and thick streams of paint. Meritu's work conveys a layering and compression of time, space, and place, and a collapse of art historical references from the dynamism of the Italian futurists to the enveloping scale of abstract expressionist color field painting. In her highly worked paintings, Meritu creates new narratives using abstracted images of cities, histories, wars, and geographies with a frenetic mark-making that for the artist becomes a way of signifying social agency as well as suggesting an unraveling of personal biography. I think this is an exquisite work, if only for the compositional achievement and the mixed materials and the mastery of it all. Yeah, you get a sense of tumult at the center and things whipping out of control, and there's no hope for recourse here, I think, but again, sublime beauty and destruction in one. Meritus' points of departure are architecture in the city, particularly the accelerated, compressed, and densely populated urban environments of the 21st century. Her paintings present a tornado of visual incident where gridded cities become fluid and flattened like many layers of urban graffiti. The next young painter we're going to look at is Thoma Abts. She is a young German painter. She had a show recently at the New Museum, which was really exquisite. I was torn about this painting because at first meeting, I sort of thought there was something really beautifully drunk about it. But there is a very empirical position that it holds, and so I decided to go with, you know, what she claims as her method. So Thoma Abts' paintings are the result of a rigorous work method that pitches the rational against the intuitive. She works consistently to a format of 48 by 38 centimeters in acrylic and oil paint. She uses no source material and begins with no preconceived idea of the final result. Instead, her paintings take shape through a gradual process of layering and accrual. As the internal logic of each composition unfolds, forms are defined, buried, and rediscovered until the painting becomes congruent with itself. So again, sort of melding this geometric abstraction with darker forces. And when I saw this painting, I thought of that one from the Museum of Modern Art, The Empress of India by Frank Stella. And if time permitted and mind permitted, you know, I'd have liked to explored his influence on the young minimalists and abstractionists. But here I think there's an interesting relationship with the geometry of Stella and Thoma's wonderfully laid out canvases. And now we're going to move on to the next segment, which is what I call the hybridity of abstraction and figuration. Now, abstraction and figuration are always at each other's heels. In many ways, this lecture could not come full circle without the hybridity of abstraction and figuration. So this is Rossen Crowe, the great Rossen Crowe, who we are so excited will be at the museum in a few weeks. This is that painting previous was based on this Jason Rhodes installation. This, I think, is the kind of fully realized representational version of that painting, and vice versa. Because I'm sure not knowing the extent of each other's work. I mean, he died a few years ago. But, you know, Rossen really investigates interiors to great effect. She is one of the few young artists who I think has developed her own language, one that she can excavate to no end. I mean, often you find young artists are either reappropriating or combining or really sitting on the weight of history. And I think Rawson does to some extent, but she has really formed her own vocabulary with this meeting of figure and abstraction. So here you have a sordid interior. I think her palette is exquisite, combination of colors, and the way there's a sort of illumination inside the work. So what we call her large, badass, brassy paintings are inspired by the humming neon of dive bars, strip malls, and vintage interiors. The grimy and tackiest corners of American life come together in her abstract splattering of paint. This one is also interesting. It is titled, What Happened to the Cash After CBGB's? I don't know if you know CBGB's, famous club in New York. It had its heyday in the 80s. But again, just, you know, this, because here I think she is able to resolve perspectival space and, you know, the two dimensionality of the canvas, the material, this tearing, this conflict between pure modernist theory, Greenbergian theory, and, you know, traditional normative figurative painting. I think there's it works, the unison, there's a unison and there is definitely harmony. The next artist we're going to look at is Kristen Baker. Kristen has an interesting history. Kristen started initially as a fully figurative painter and just a very sort of timid young lady, but depicted this very masculine thing, an American thing of NASCAR racing. So she was really into speed and chaos, and eventually she started investigating the crashes in her paintings. And thereafter came explosive imagery. And now Kristen uses what we call a tape technique. So she doesn't sort of very furtively take paintbrush to canvas. She layers, she sort of tapes out the area that she wants to put a certain color, then lets it dry, then adds another layer, then tapes and tapes and tapes, which, you know, when I think about it, is a very time-consuming affair. I mean, it takes quite a bit of time to make her paintings, but I think this was one of her first forays into almost full abstraction. This is one of my favorite paintings of hers because this is based on Géricault's Wrath of Medusa. I just fell in love with the combination of colors and sort of weight on the left side, the left panel, and the sort of a rapturous sea and strange colors, but somehow making a very strong case for the original work, which is this. The next painting is, I think, sort of her grown-up painting. I think this was when she started to really take some huge leaps of faith. This painting was in the Substraction show, and this is called Sturm und Drang, which is storm and stress. And, you know, there's something just really mysterious and breathtaking and at the same time sinister about this painting. There's something happening there at the point, purple point at which all this madness radiates from. We don't know, but you see a hint of a yellow strip in the road, something speeding, you get a kind of futuristic quality of the continuity of motion. And I think this is, I love it. I love this painting. So the next artist we're going to look at is Joe Bradley. Joe Bradley, he's a great young artist, and at first glance, Joe's abstract monochromatic canvases look like experiments in minimalism. A longer viewing, however, reveals surprising levels of figuration and what Bradley calls an intentional shoddiness that points to the dissatisfaction with the narrative of 20th century painting. His depictions of people, animals, places, and objects are visually distilled rectangles of color and blocky forms that hung in sets on the wall communicate an overall sense of theater and movement. The minute I saw Joe's work, I thought he was really onto something, because no one really approached what I thought at first was minimalism in this very pure way, then sort of spin it around in his head and say that it is representation, which is what we were talking about earlier. Abstraction as representation. Interesting. This is the view of his room at the Whitney Biennial last year. I wish I had some images of his new work to show you. I mean, sort of work done in the last part of 2008 and 2009. He's sort of grappling with what's next. Where does one go after this very pure form? Where does one go? How does one elevate the discussion that you're trying to have when you've taken the most complex and brought it to its purest? Okay, so next is the section I fondly call the sort of punk abstraction. And I say that because there's a sort of laconic approach. There's a softness. There's a remove from the intense perfection of form. There is something a little bit more organic and fun and easygoing about this kind of abstraction. And this is by a young painter named Josh Smith, who's had relatively good success in his short years in the art world. And he addresses painting abstractly through a variety of historical references. You know, he's clever. He's a clever. He's clever at working the canvas, at opposing shapes and opposing colors, but yet with a kind of a laissez-faire, like a, you know, like he didn't really think that much about it or that long or hard, and that he painted it in 2 minutes. But there is something genuinely harmonious about this work. And at first I saw one, I said, oh no, I'm not going to like this. And I saw the other, and I said, oh, let me see the third, and then let me see the fourth. And I think he's onto something. The next new abstractionist, you might recognize her. She's not new at all, but has definitely made quite a swirl on the contemporary scene and, you know, kind of devoted fans and loyal followers. This is Mary Heilman. And Mary has had a sort of a long and hedonistic and fantastic love affair with the art world and with abstraction in general for many, many, many years. There's definitely a sort of irreverence and joie de vivre to her works. But, you know, there's something really, really accomplished. You can see that she has spent time working through the measurement and just these measures of space and relation to smaller spaces and that sort of stuff. This is also another work by her. I think color is one of the most exciting parts of her artistic dialogue. There is something really, really fascinating and irreverent about her stuff, and I appreciate that she continues to push her ideas forward. Now, next is a young painter called Matt Connor. He makes very small-scale abstractions. He considers the paintings pictorial representation of fantasy. And I connected with his work immediately. I thought he was looking definitely at the history of painting. You see Barnett Newman simultaneously with Peter Halley, but not trying to outdo one or both. A sort of accepting that, you know, he comes after and that he will have to excavate some other form to have their sort of purity. Next we have, this is also a work by Matt, and this is called Unopened Letter. I like how his lines and the orchestra of, you know, shapes and gesture and brushwork and color, and I think he's onto something. This was my favorite piece, though. I like this one quite a bit. I like this one quite a bit. Next we have a young painter, Scott Olson. He has he recombines and repurposes traditional modernist abstraction and sort of, you know, pulls it back out again. So the aim is to be the opposite of this pure and exquisite form. Again, I think composition, palette, texture, great. And that's our final painting. So, any questions? You can ask anything, yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the pieces that, and I'd say maybe the majority of what you showed seems to me to have a kind of aggression environment that certainly makes me think of the futurist.
Mm-hmm.
But my understanding of the futurist is that that's coming out of this moment of potential.
Of course.
You know, do away with the old, embrace the new, excitement.
Yes.
I sense that it's something different for this generation.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. I mean, I think... you know, there was an optimism with the futurists at the turn of the 20th century. And, yeah, I mean, they'd faced tremendous difficulty with the war behind them, the war in front, I mean, the war ahead of, in front of them. It's sort of just an evolutionary process. I think what happens is that time passes, experiences are had, ideas are reaped, ideas are produced, and then they're gone. They're not going to be anyone else's again. And I just think there is a kind of resignation with our generation because, you know, so much of what has happened is not because of us, you know? And... yeah, but at the same time, I do think that moving into 2009 has provided extreme circumstances of optimism for us and what the world can be with someone like Barack Obama as president. It sort of unhinges all the old traditions that have weighed us down and that hold no hope for our future, if, you know, one is to be had. So I think that, you know, painting an art, for that matter, as a mirror of society is just trying to tell that story. I do expect the art at the end of 2009 to be maybe a little bit more slightly charged with optimism. But yeah, I think, you know, when a lot of this work was coming out, there was a very, very like fatalistic view of the world and of their position in America that was falling far behind because of, you know, politics and, you know, things out of their control.
Mm-hmm. I think it makes me think, of course, of your description of the presentation, you know, their response to a world gone mad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. So I suppose trying to capture that, to that anger and that madness and that angst and that, you know, that's very real, and it's not going to be solved overnight either, because this is a long time coming, you know. Stress and density, stress, storm and stress, you know. I mean, stress, it's a real thing. It's a real thing for us.
Even the absurdity of, like, the bird shit thing.
Exactly, exactly. The absurdity, but the lyricism of it, too.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
I got a question. You know, it's refreshing to hear you talk about these painters, because it seemed like for so many years, artists have always tried to be different from the past, and we keep bringing the past back,
mm-hmm.
showing how they relate to the past,
mm-hmm.
as if it's one congruent thought.
Mm-hmm.
And do you feel like it is, or because there was a discussion on modernism?
Yeah,
I see a lot of modernism in these paintings.
Of course, absolutely.
It's like a neo-modernism.
Absolutely. Well, that's why I sort of preface the entire lecture with what Matisse said, which is that. All great discoveries in art and life are simple, familiar truths seen new. I mean, I think that there is a kind of inevitability of there being no more new ideas. You know, you can sort of rework the relationship of the idea with society and the relationship that the artist has with the idea, him or herself, but in fact, there will always be an opportunity to say that this reminds me of this, or this reminds me of this, or this calls, because that's free association. That's what we do as humans. It's impossible to remove one association from another. So I think we're just doomed. Any other questions? Oh, yeah.
One word that hasn't come out in your talk, which is understandable. Where does representation come in relation to the development of abstraction? A lot of our images are very graphic. But somehow the abstraction comes out and we don't know where it comes from. What do they do with all the tremendous...
That's the next lecture. That's the next lecture, figurative painting. I think, well, I'll be honest with you. The trajectory, when you look at the trajectory of the art world and the relationship to the art market, the last, I would say, 10 years, and I could argue even more, representation and figuration have been at the fore for so long. And I think young artists always trying to break from what's, you know, common charge or, you know, commonplace. I think that's a relationship to it. They're running the opposite way.
And there is representation. I mean, I think it's interesting that their abstraction comes often from things that actually exist in the world, like.
Mm-hmm. Course. Now, yeah, I mean, part of the reality is that there is Yeah, there's, I mean, they're not pure abstraction. This is not pure abstraction by any stretch. This is not pure abstraction. This is kind of travel of from the figure to representation to somewhat abstraction to full abstraction. I think we sort of ran the gamut and tried to give a story of... But I think the ideologies are more in line with modernist thinking, which is probably why, you know, leaning towards the side of what one can clearly see is not, you know, a mainstay. Anything else? Any other questions?
Where do you take the sunset picture?
Oh, my hometown, Jamaica. Oh, my home island, Jamaica. That was the first abstraction, actually. That was the first as a God-given abstraction. Yay! Thank you. Thanks, everyone.